Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, or MPN. And today is part two of a six-part series, and today's workshop focuses on the importance of finding the resources you need to deal with MPN. And we have wonderful faculty today in our program today. We have this program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and MPN organizations as well, both the MPN Foundation and the MPN Education Foundation and the MPN Research Foundation. So it's that collaboration and with all the other organizations that has made our program really able to reach so many of you. And we have on the call today over 317 participants. You come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Spain, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela, so truly from all over the world. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, information about our speakers, about the topics they'll be addressing. Also, there is information about all of the different collaborating organizations and how to contact them for information or additional help. And there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all at the end of the program today to complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs and topics that we should offer going forward? This is the beginning of a new year, and we are planning many programs. Actually, as we speak, we're planning many programs, and I actually very much rely upon your feedback for topics that would be most relevant to meet your specific needs. And indeed, this series really came out of many of your recommendations for topics. And so so tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to provide that. Today's program and this entire series was made possible by the Insight Corporation. I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker for today. And our first speaker is Dr. Gail Robos. And Dr. Robos is a Director of Leukemia Program, Associate Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Robos is going to address an overview of MPN, common symptoms, and questions to ask your doctor. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Robos.
Thank you so much, and it is my pleasure to be on the call today. And what I'm hoping to accomplish in my 11 minutes is to start out with a review of MPN and then go over common questions, common symptoms and questions to ask the doctor. So the first thing is that although this is a six-part series, I want to reassure really everybody on the call that even our fellows and residents and postdocs in academic medicine take a lot more than six classes to understand the myeloproliferative neoplasms. So for everybody who's on the call, and presumably everybody has either a friend or a family member or somebody who's dealing with an MPN, take courage that these are actually a group of disorders that are quite challenging to understand even for people in the field, let alone for those who have just been given a multi-syllable term that they really don't understand. So have patience with yourself, and I'm going to try to break things down a little bit to make this fairly wide-flung area a little bit more clear for the group. So to break down the terminology, myelo means bone marrow, and proliferative generally means making a lot of. So the concept in these diseases is that usually white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets, either one, two, or all three cell lines are overproduced by the bone marrow. So the general concept of the term is that there's too much. Now, many of you on the call may have too much of white cells or too much of platelets and too few of another, so these diseases don't behave necessarily in an organized manner, but they usually start out with some level of overproduction, and that is something that might be noticed routinely in a laboratory test that's done as part of a routine physical, or it might be picked up because somebody is presenting with a symptom, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. The second term also will give everybody pause because neoplasm is actually reasonably new in conjunction with the myeloproliferative disorders. And many of you who might have been dealing with this for years might have noticed that we kind of switched the name of your disease because they used to be called either myeloproliferative diseases or myeloproliferative disorders. And what happened that they're now called myeloproliferative neoplasms? Most people know that a neoplasm, neo means new, plasm is growth, that's a cancer. And I have to say that many patients were not particularly happy that their disorder had been renamed a neoplasm. But actually, improved understanding of the biology and pathogenesis of these diseases led to the change in terminology to more appropriately reflect their origin from a stem cell. And these are, in fact, malignant conditions. They are considered cancers, but it's not bone cancer. It's not a bone tumor, and it's not a cancer the way most people think of cancer as a lump somewhere that you want to cut out. So that terminology has caused some consternation, I think, for both people in the field and for patients, but it does accurately reflect what we know is their malignant behavior. The other side effect, by the way, of renaming disorders was that actually they were able to get more in the way of insurance and other benefit coverage because previously there were patients who had been labeled having a disease or a disorder who actually couldn't get cancer type of benefits that they're now eligible for, and that may be addressed later on in the program. But I'm trying to put that out there as not only an important change in the understanding of the disease, but also as a silver lining in perhaps the benefits that are duly and correctly afforded to patients with these particular conditions. Now, it used to be that the myeloproliferative diseases referred to a few diseases that were pretty different both in the way they sounded and the way they presented clinically. So chronic myeloid leukemia, essential thrombocythemia, polycythemia vera, and myelofibrosis have typically been categorized as the four myeloproliferative neoplasms. This type of terminology and this type of distinction is actually rapidly fading as the similarities between many of the myeloproliferative neoplasms become more clear and the differences start to fade away. This is not a conference about CML. CML, or chronic myeloid leukemia, is the one myeloproliferative disorder that is quite different from the others, both in terms of pathogenesis and in treatment, so we'll leave that for its own conference. But polycythemia vera used to be thought of as a disease of red cells. Essential thrombocytosis or essential thrombocythemia used to be thought of as a disease of platelets, and myelofibrosis used to be thought of as a disease of a big spleen. And actually, if you start reading about them online, they sound very different, and some of the clinical problems that patients have are very different. So it comes as a surprise to many people that we sometimes, as clinicians and scientists, have a lot of difficulty distinguishing between them, because sometimes the bone marrow biology, the bone marrow pathology, the peripheral blood counts and the patient, the way the patient looks and feels, doesn't necessarily exactly distinguish between these disorders that sound very different. So one of the take-home messages from all of the conferences today is that rather than working hard to try to exactly pigeonhole what is the name of what I have, which is something that frankly most people really do want to know, what is it that I have, to understand that there will be quite a few patients who actually fall kind of in between these old names. And that's okay. It's just making what you write down on a piece of paper, what you tell your friends and family, even more complicated. Now, if you come to the common symptoms part of my talk, that will underscore some of these points that I've already made, that it used to be that people would kind of put the common symptoms into very distinct categories. So polycythemia vera patients more often would have, let's say, redness of the face or redness of their hands or a throbbing feeling in their head or burning of the hands and feet or itching in the body, especially after a hot shower, is a common symptom called aquagenic pruritus. And these were things that were classically associated with PV, but candidly are fair game for anybody with a myeloproliferative disorder. These types of symptoms, of course, could be caused by a million other things, and that's also something for everybody on the call to think about, that some of the signs and symptoms might be associated with a billion other things. So if you tell somebody that, well, I had itching and now I have a myeloproliferative disorder, obviously there are billions of people with itching and very few with myeloproliferative disorders, so we have to keep in mind that these are reasonably nonspecific. Some of the more specific ones are related to abnormal blood counts, which are identified either because somebody went in with a symptom or because somebody had a routine blood evaluation. And sometimes those types of numbers, elevated white cells, elevated red cells, elevated platelets, can lead then to further hematologic workup. And that further hematologic workup will often involve, currently in 2014, an assessment of at least the JAK2, J-A-K-2 mutation, which is a very important part of the biology of these diseases and is seen in most patients with PV and many with essential thrombocytosis or myelofibrosis. So that is something that's being used currently, even in patients where the doctor might not have been positive that the patient even has an MPD or MPN. They use the presence of a JAK2 mutation sometimes to make the specific diagnostic distinction, and that might be something that then brings together some of the initial presenting symptoms. Other symptoms to think about, almost everybody with a bone marrow issue complains of fatigue. That is a common one. There can be sometimes night sweats. There could be weight loss. Sometimes patients who have an enlarged spleen will notice a bulge in their belly or that they have to loosen their belt or that they may find that they're only able to eat a small amount in a meal before actually kind of giving up and saying that they're not hungry, and that can be due to compression of the stomach by an enlarged spleen. So when you're going to the doctor and trying to figure out what it is that you have, the first thing is to try to put a list together of what are the problems that characterize whatever this disease is, because you may as well resign to the fact that you're going to be given a disease with a bunch of letters and initials and possibly a long name. But before we get there, what are the problems that I have? I've got itching, I've got sweating, I've got a low appetite, I feel tired. So you put together a list of your symptoms. Then you put together a list of what is being identified objectively by the doctor. What's the matter with my blood counts? What's the matter with my physical exam? What are you finding on me that you shouldn't? Is my spleen bigger than it should be? Do I have anything on my body that I shouldn't have? And then you get into the discussion of, well, how are we going to make a diagnosis of a myeloproliferative neoplasm? Are we going to do a bone marrow biopsy? What are the findings of the bone marrow biopsy? And the answer to that question, by the way, should be absolutely yes. You should not be walking around with the diagnosis of a myeloproliferative neoplasm without having had a bone marrow biopsy to see what the status is of the bone marrow. And then once you put all of that together, you get to the doctor to answer the question of, well, which one of the myeloproliferative neoplasms does this most closely fit into in terms of category? And what are the problems that I need to worry about with this disease? Do I need to worry about blood clots? Do I need to worry about getting anemic? Do I need to worry about taking a medication, or are we just going to follow this over time? And I think that if you have those initial building blocks of what are my symptoms and what are the findings, the objective findings on my physical exam and on my diagnostic tests, that helps you then have the conversation with the doctor of, well, what are the problems here that we need to fix and how are we going to fix them? Because an important point about myeloproliferative neoplasms is that patients may have them for a very, very long time. There are plenty of patients who were diagnosed 20, 25, even 30 years with a myeloproliferative neoplasm. So the important part is to figure out what's the problem that's going to bug me now and how do I deal with it? What are the problems that might bug me later, and is there anything I need to do about them proactively? Is there anything that can be done about them? Or do we just watch and wait and see what happens, which in the current environment of rapid scientific growth and exploding medical knowledge of the myeloproliferative neoplasms is actually not a bad place to be sitting, because we are very sure that in the next few years, the conversations that we're going to be having are very, very different, even from those that we're having today. And I'm going to leave that as an introduction, if Carolyn says I'm allowed to, and turn it over to my colleague.
Well, that was really wonderful, Dr. Robles. Just a wonderful introduction and helping people understand about myeloproliferative neoplasm, and also just your whole presentation. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Brady Stein. And Dr. Stein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine. And Dr. Stein is going to be addressing getting up-to-date information about myeloproliferative neoplasm, communicating with your healthcare team, accessing state-of-the-art medical, treatment, and clinical trial information. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Stein.
So thank you very much, Dr. Messner, for the introduction and the opportunity. My one major disclosure is I've got a cold, and I might cough. Hopefully that's not too distracting. I'd also like to thank Dr. Robles. That was really an excellent overview, and I'm not sure I can articulate any better, but I'd also like to make the emphasis. I'm going to start with communicating to your healthcare team. We're going to talk a lot about information and where you can get it from, but I'd like to start by asking you about the information we need. So as was discussed in the overview, when we monitor the MPNs, there's certain things we can do to monitor the disease objectively. So of course we can follow the complete blood counts. We can measure the spleen either with our physical exam or with ultrasounds or certain situations, CAT scans, and we can assess the health and function of the bone marrow. We can do this objectively, but as Dr. Robles stated, there are many really important subjective symptoms that patients with MPNs suffer from, and we really need to hear your perception, your reporting of these symptoms, symptoms we can't measure necessarily with a test, symptoms like fatigue, pruritus, sweats being an example. So one emphasis is for you to communicate that to us. We need to hear your perceptions. We need your input. We now have a class of medications that are essentially symptom-directed. So that's the first point I'd like to make about communicating with your healthcare provider, how important it is to track your symptoms and to communicate your symptoms. It really tells us about whether our therapy is appropriate for you or whether we need to make a change in our therapeutic strategy. So the second part is, where can you get information from? So in the ideal world, first and foremost, you would get a very comprehensive evaluation and set of information about MPNs from your doctor. So that is the ideal world, those face-to-face visits after your diagnosis and during follow-up. But of course, we know that the visits often don't seem long enough, certainly from the patient's perspective, from the doctor's perspective as well. So we know that it can't always happen that way. We also know that when you're seeing your hematologist-oncologist, you may be a relatively rare patient in the practice. Your hematologist-oncologist may be seeing many different diseases during the course of the day, blood clotting complications, lung cancer, pancreas cancer, breast cancer. So you may be a relatively rare patient in the practice, and what that means is that it may be very difficult for your doctor to keep up on MPN information. And thankfully, there is essentially an explosion in discovery and scientific advancement in this field. There's a rapid pace of information coming. So certainly it's a challenge for your doctor to keep up. So what that means is that you're going to have to seek information from other sources. So if I think about those other sources, one point of emphasis that I'd like to make is that I think it's very reasonable to have an MPN team and have a shared care approach, meaning you have your doctor that's near your home. So it's very easy for your doctor or healthcare provider near your home to handle the routine, checking your blood counts, if a transfusion is needed, providing that transfusion or performing it near your home. I think that's very, very important for the routine to be done in a relatively stress-free way near your home. But I also think it's important to establish contact with an MPN expert, to have a second opinion, especially if you're not getting enough information from your hematologist, oncologist, or healthcare provider. So seek the opinion of an authority or someone at a university who thinks about MPNs on a daily basis. And what happens is that you have a team member, someone who can put a face to your name, someone that you or your doctor can contact in the future to discuss the latest and the greatest. May there be, there's a new scientific discovery, maybe there's a new important clinical trial, or a new way of doing things. You also have a contact for reaching out if your MPN is changing. If you need to make a major decision, you have a contact. So that's my second piece of advice, is to establish a team. Have a shared care approach between your doctor who is near you and perhaps someone who specializes in MPN. And that's another way of keeping up to date, of getting information. Even then, because there's so much information and you can't always necessarily see your MPN expert, perhaps for some patients this could be hours away, so travel may not be convenient. So that means you're going to have to seek other resources to get information, and thankfully there are a number of them. And I by no means mean to be exclusive, and I know Dr. Messner has provided you with a list of resources where you can get really up-to-date and effective information on MPNs. I'm just going to highlight a couple that I work with, a couple that resources I share with my patients in the clinic. And being from Chicago, we work very, very closely with the MPN Research Foundation. They happen to be about 9 blocks from my office. So I know them very well, and I know their website very well. And I think this is a good place to look to get more information. The information is thoroughly reviewed by a scientific advisor, but it's also written in a manner that is understandable. We know that we don't always communicate as well as we'd like to, especially when we write. So it's translated in a way that I think is accessible to you. There's basic overviews of each of the MPNs that we've discussed today. So there's the basic, but there's a broad spectrum, and there's going to be important information about scientific advancements. There will be updates from major meetings, so a section of what you should know or what you should take from in terms of the presentations at our American Society of Hematology meeting, which occurs every December. So there's a section on that written by the scientific advisor. There's also a listing of clinical trials. And so for some patients with MPN, perhaps many patients with MPN, a clinical trial is appropriate. We're still really trying to define the ideal treatment approach for many patients with MPN, and perhaps we get more definition from some important clinical trials that are going to be conducted or underway now. Another group is the MPN Education or MPN Advocacy Group, and these they work or actually are a spinoff of the MPN Research Foundation. So this is a foundation that helps put on patient symposiums. And so they put on these events across the country and the United States. The next one is in Tampa. The last one was in Washington, D.C. Previous events have been in Atlanta and Michigan. So these are events where MPN specialists are recruited to give presentations to patients. This can be another really important source of information, helping update you about what's new, what's exciting, how treatments are changing. Now, we know you can't all go to these events. The important thing is that these events eventually are put on the web so you can view the videos. This is another really important source of information. I'd also highlight the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, who has excellent overviews and video interviews with MPN experts. So And of course, cancer care. I figured you're on this call, so you know very, very well about cancer care. But cancer care is very dedicated to providing very high-level, practical information about MPNs. And as you know, this is part of a six-session series. So cancer care is really vital in helping us get the word out and disseminate information and practical tips, support for MPN patients and family. So that's my brief section about where you can get information. I hope you found that helpful. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Stein. That was excellent and very comprehensive, and that information is very useful to everyone on the call. So thank you. Our next speaker is Sarah Kelly. Sarah is an oncology social worker. She's coordinator of older adult services at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address how to find resources for the medical and indirect costs of living with MPN, resources for the emotional and social impact of coping with MPN, and finding someone to talk to about your concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, and I'd also like to thank Dr. Robos and Dr. Stein. I think we've got a lot of good information on this call. And to disclose, I also have a cold, so if I cough or I sneeze, I apologize. So as Carolyn said, my name is Sarah Kelly, and I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. And I'm going to be speaking about a major concern for people who are diagnosed with MPN, which is how am I going to pay for my care? It can be an expensive illness, and financial concerns are understandable, and they can also be a significant source of stress. I think that having an open conversation about the cost can help you become better informed about your financial options, and also it may be able to help you reduce the financial impact of your illness and therefore reduce some of that stress. I think when it comes to managing medical expenses, it pays to be informed and upfront. So one of the first things I'm going to talk about, just briefly, because I know Deborah Wolf is here and she's going to talk about this a little bit more in depth, is understanding your insurance policy so you're not blindsided by charges. Reading your policy carefully to understand your benefits, contacting the health insurance provider with any questions that come up that you might have. You want to find out what portion of those expenses you're responsible for paying. Also, your insurance company may be able to assign you a case manager to help you, so definitely ask them about that. If you're not covered under health insurance, you want to talk to your treatment center, the hospital financial services department, your local department of health. You want to find out what benefits you may be eligible for, and you want to apply for them as soon as you can. The next thing I think that could be helpful is keeping a diary of your expenses, whether you do it on the computer or you actually sort of keep it in a journal or a spiral notebook. I like this because it helps you to catch any kind of billing errors. That's something that often happens. Let's say you'll get a bill and it may be for the wrong amount. You want to make sure that you're catching any of that as it happens, and it also helps to just kind of give you an idea of where you are financially. You also want to talk to the healthcare team as soon as you can about your financial situation. Sometimes providers don't ask patients about their coverage or ability to pay. Also, patients may not always feel comfortable doing that or sharing that information. And I think it's a way of resolving financial issues, again, that really increase your stress, but also that can limit access to the treatments you may need. And I think that patients and the providers can work together really to devise a way of reducing the cost without compromising your treatment. I recommend connecting with the financial services department of the hospital or doctor's office or treatment center. Connect with a social worker there or a patient advocate. The treatment center may offer a payment plan for you. They may be able to reduce charges. They also may have special funding available. It never hurts to ask. You know, you definitely want to find out about this. The other thing, don't ignore bills, which can sometimes happen if you're feeling overwhelmed. When they come in, do what you can to resolve them right then and there. And I say that because once they go to collections, it can be a little bit harder to resolve. Now, all of this may sound overwhelming or like a really tall order when you're not feeling well. But there are some organizations that can help or at least help direct you to resources that you can get help with. So aside from the treatment center, aside from the hospital or doctor's office, where can you go for information? And I'd like to start with two organizations that are specific to MPN, and actually Dr. Stein mentioned both of them, and that's the MPN Research Foundation and the MPN Education Foundation. Both of these organizations provide a wealth of information regarding MPN. They talk about MPN itself, treatments, financial resources, which is what we're talking about now, and they also have a lot of resources on support, which I'm going to be getting to in a little bit. So they're really great. I recommend checking them out. And then other organizations, so Cancer Care, you know, we're absolutely here. You can call our Hope Line, and I'll be giving that information in a little bit. Our oncology social workers can help you find resources. We also do provide some financial assistance, so we're here. Dr. Stein also mentioned the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. They provide some copay assistance. Also, they're great in terms of resources if you're looking for places to get help. Then I also really briefly want to mention the Cancer Financial Assistance Coalition. And this is a website, really it came about a group of organizations including Cancer Care, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, came together to create a very user-friendly online database. You put in your zip code, you put in your diagnosis, and it pulls up local and national resources. And then I also just lastly want to mention the Patient Advocate Foundation, who can provide case managers really to help you address the financial concerns. So those resources should be listed. You guys should have those access to them. If you need them, call us. You know, that's what we're here for. So any of these resources, you can call us. And then I'm very briefly going to talk about specific patient assistance programs that are out there to help you with copays or medications if you need them. So we've already talked a lot about Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. They have a copay program for patients who are diagnosed with MPN. The Patient Access Network is another that offers copay assistance. And then the Chronic Disease Fund. And one thing I'll say about the Chronic Disease Fund, currently they only have assistance for myelofibrosis. So just know that if you're looking to them for assistance. And again, there should be a listing of these organizations. And also, if you need the information, we're here. So for the financial piece, looking for resources, finding ways of sort of managing and handling those costs before they get too overwhelming, get informed, speak up, and then get organized. And I'm just going to shift gears a little bit to talk about another important resource that I feel you'll need on your journey, which is support. And creating a support network. I liked how Dr. Stein talked about the, you know, your MPN team. Support absolutely can be a part of that. And I'm going to talk a little bit just about cancer care, what we do, and how we can be a part of it. Many of you are on the call today and know what we do. We're a national nonprofit organization. We provide free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling, which we do face-to-face in the New York area and over the phone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York and over the phone nationally, and actually online nationally and internationally. We have education programs like the one we're on today. We provide practical help and also help you navigate the healthcare system. In addition, we do provide some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. Our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are really trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. We are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, which we've been talking about, physical changes, social adjustment, psychological impact, and overall care. And I think adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis is another important part of the healing process. So, you know, as you may know, MPN affects the whole person and the entire family support network. It affects so many areas of your life. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker is so helpful and a huge sign of strength. You know, you really don't have to walk this path alone. With a support group, you can connect to others who are going through a similar situation. With the individual counseling, it really is a space that's just yours to voice any concerns. And I feel like these connections help lessen the isolation that can come with the diagnosis. Feeling well emotionally really helps you better deal with the diagnosis and also the treatment. At this time, I'm just going to share a little bit about what we're providing. Cancer Care offers an online support group for people diagnosed with blood cancers. We also provide caregiver groups face-to-face in the New York area and on the phone nationally and online nationally and internationally. If you're interested in any of these groups, you can go to our website to register. You can also contact us on our Hope Line, and that number is 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And then you can also visit our website, which is www.cancercare.org. And our website is very comprehensive. There's a lot of information, not only on support, but also on all of our programs. We've learned a lot from today's program. I know there's a lot of information to take in and to get your arms around. We're here. Know that we're here to help you understand what it means for you and your family. We can help you sort of prioritize your needs. We can help you with the financial resources. We can help you communicate with your medical team. You know, call us. You're not alone in this, and we're really here to help you. Thank you for your attention and opportunity to talk. Thanks.
Oh, thank you very much, Sarah. That was really wonderful and really an excellent description of the various resources as well as just the importance of getting support and counseling during the way as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Deborah Wolf. And Ms. Wolf is a senior attorney, Legal Help, New York Legal Assistance Group. She's an attorney. And Deborah is going to address understanding the benefits and limitations of your health coverage and tips on appealing medical insurance claims and provider denials. And it's really my pleasure to introduce and to have Deborah on the call today. So I turn the program over to Ms. Wolf.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And I'm very pleased to be a part of this teleconference with Cancer Care. There have been a lot of positive changes in health coverage over the past year, and I'll first be discussing how to best understand both the benefits and limitations on your health coverage, and then talk a bit about appealing health insurance decisions. Now, in discussing health coverage as well as appeals, it's important to know that there are different types of insurance plans, and these include group policies from employment, union benefits, privately purchased policies, as well as policies now available through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. I'll also briefly discuss Medicaid and Medicare. The insurance laws of your state may also require certain minimum benefits, so your rights may vary depending on where you live. This will be very general advice relating to everybody, but it's also important to understand the laws of the state you live in. As a start, and as Sarah mentioned, the most important advice I can give is to have and read a copy of your policy or a summary description of your policy. This is going to outline your benefits, any coverage limits, and the appeals process, which we'll discuss in a bit. It'll also give you information about your share of expenses, which can include copays, coinsurance, or annual deductibles. Now, your insurance company can also be a very good resource to call if you have questions about what is or is not covered under your plan. I'm sure everyone has heard of some of the good changes with the Affordable Care Act, and I want to review a few that have impacted benefits for everyone. So starting this year, 2014, insurers must sell and renew health insurance regardless of health status. This is called guaranteed issue, and a person can't be denied insurance based on their health. Also, insurers can no longer refuse coverage of pre-existing conditions. Another important change that has already made a big impact for many of the people I work with is the requirement that insurance companies can no longer limit the amount they will pay for medical costs over a year or the person's lifetime. There are no more monetary caps on coverage. This means an insurance company can no longer say, once we spend a certain amount of money, you are no longer covered. So this has been an excellent change. A health insurance marketplace will now operate in every state. And with this, you can go onto the website, compare different plan benefits, see if you may be entitled to subsidies to lower the cost, and determine if you may be eligible for free coverage under Medicaid. Now, all plans must now cover essential health benefits, which is a long list, which includes outpatient and emergency services, prescriptions, hospitalization, mental health, preventive care, and more. But even with all these good changes, policies can still limit certain coverages. This might include the number of physical therapy visits, home nursing, or mental health visits allowed per year. Any of these limits or exclusions must be set forth in your policy or the description of your policy. So again, important to read this and really check in and read it every few months so that you continue to have an understanding of what your plan offers. If your policy requires pre-authorization, and most do for major medical procedures and radiology such as PET scans or MRIs, make sure you check to make sure that the procedure's been approved. And if you have an HMO, make sure all your doctors are in the network. And if you're having surgery as well, make sure all doctors involved are in network. Moving to Medicare and Medicaid, these are both government-sponsored health insurance plans, and both have been improved with the Affordable Care Act. Medicare is a federal program with rules that are uniform to all participants in all 50 states. It's available to most people age 65 or older who are citizens or permanent residents, and if under age 65, a person who's been receiving Social Security disability benefits for a period of 24 months. Medicare is not available to others except in very limited circumstances. Now, Medicare coverage consists of a number of parts. Part A, which provides free hospital coverage. Part B, which is medical insurance, which requires a monthly premium. Part D, the prescription drug insurance plans, which are provided through private insurance companies that have contracts with the government. And then there's also Part C, which allows private health insurance companies, such as HMOs, to provide Medicare benefits. These Medicare private health plans are sometimes known as Medicare Advantage plans. Similar to private insurance, with the change in the laws, you will now get more preventive services for less, as well as a free annual wellness visit. The Part D prescription coverage will also be improved by the gradual elimination of the donut hole, which will result in increased prescription benefits. Now, many people purchase additional Medicare gap policies to supplement Medicare, and I want to point out that these policies are exempt from most of the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, and they even have a pre-existing condition exclusion that is enforceable. So make sure to read these plans and ask questions to make sure you understand all of the benefits available to you with these plans. Moving to Medicaid, this is a insurance, and it's a federal-state partnership with shared authority and shared financing. Certain eligibility rules are established mainly by each state and vary on where you live, so it's important to understand your state Medicaid requirements. Access is based on being low income, with a limit on how much you can have in income, assets, and resources. For those who are disabled or over 65 with higher income, one can often become eligible through special Medicaid programs. With the Affordable Care Act in most states, Medicaid has been expanded to increase coverage to more lower-income people, including groups such as childless couples that have not always had access to coverage. And as I mentioned earlier, one application will determine eligibility for Medicaid or a plan through the marketplace with a subsidy. Medicaid recipients are also entitled to the same benchmark benefit package that meets the minimum essential health benefits that are available to everybody through health insurance exchanges. And the goal is to enhance the quality of care for everybody, regardless of whether they have private insurance, Medicare, or Medicaid. Now, even with these new protections, claims are sometimes denied. Your insurance company is required to provide an explanation of benefit, or EOB, for each claim reviewed. The EOB outlines the amount paid, your required contribution, which could be your copay or coinsurance, and if they're not paying, the reasons for the denial. It's important to read every EOB to make sure your claim has been paid, and if not, the reason for the denial. When a claim is denied, your first step should be to call the insurance company right away to discuss. There are many reasons a claim may be denied, and often the insurance company just needs more documentation from your doctor's office to approve. Claims are also sometimes denied for administrative reasons that are easy to fix. For example, the claim has an incorrect code or incorrect policy number. But do make sure to keep track of every call or letter, writing down the date and who you spoke to. If the matter can't be resolved by speaking with the insurance company, you have the right to file an appeal directly to your insurance company. In your written appeal, document the reasons you disagree with the insurance company, and always include medical records and a letter from your treating doctor. In fact, I often ask the treating doctor to review the reasons for the denial and then add a response in writing. Your insurance company must conduct a full and fair review of its decision and may be required to expedite if the case is urgent. If your insurance company denies the appeal, you will then have the right to request an external review, which gives you the right to file an appeal to an outside, objective, and independent panel, no matter where you live or what type of insurance you have. This means that independent medical professionals make the decision, and your insurance company no longer gets the final say over many benefit decisions, and over 50% of appealed claims are generally reversed and paid. Another important Affordable Care Act protection will be expanded consumer assistance. This requires that states designate an independent Office of Health Insurance Consumer Assistance that will respond to inquiries and complaints by consumers and help file appeals. So this can be a very useful resource when you're looking for coverage, trying to understand your benefits, and also if you have a problem or do need to file an appeal. With Medicaid and Medicare, you're also entitled to an appeal as well as an external review if your claim is denied. And generally, with the denial or explanation of benefits, your insurance company will give you both information about how to appeal as well as the deadline, and make sure to pay careful attention to any deadlines. So to summarize, it's important to read your policy so that you understand your coverage, what's required of you, how to appeal, and any deadlines imposed. I know it's difficult to keep on top of insurance matters with so much else going on, but with an understanding of what your rights and responsibilities are, as well as help from the Affordable Care Act Consumer Assistance Program, you'll be able to navigate any insurance issues or questions that come up. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you very much, Deborah. That was really outstanding and really so helpful to have your expertise on this call. So thank you so much. And we now have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, please call the Cancer Care 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE. So just give us a call at our 800 number, and we're happy to give you a call back. Our staff will speak to you directly when you call. So, Stephanie, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, please press star then 1 to ask a question.
We have a question from one of our online participants. So, Dr. Brady, a question is about what are people's experiences with Jakafi? Could you discuss that?
Sure. So, Jakafi or ruxolitinib is the only current FDA-approved medication for myelofibrosis at this point. And the expectation from the clinical trials, and this is a medication that was developed in 2007 and approved in 2011. We now have about 3 years of clinical trial follow-up. So what are the expectations? What would I communicate to a patient if I was going to start or when I start? So we talk about the two major expectations, which are, one, the spleen should shrink. About 50% of patients roughly can have up to a 50% shrinkage in the spleen. So that's our first expectation, and that's what we're monitoring for. So again, going back to those objective things, things that we can measure, but also importantly, there's also about as high as 45% chance that the symptoms you experience at baseline, those symptoms that are there before you start the medication, there's about a 45% chance that those will considerably improve. So we're talking about symptoms like itching, night sweats, fever, bone pains. We expect patients will gain weight that they have lost. So that's the typical expectations. One, the spleen can shrink, and two, many of the symptoms related to your myelofibrosis can improve to a considerable degree. Now, the medication is in clinical trials for polycythemia vera, so we can't yet prescribe it there. So that's the expectations that I communicate to patients. The other are the side effects. We can't talk only about the positive expectations. We also expect that initially the blood counts are going to go down. So we might see a decrease most commonly in the hemoglobin, so the red blood cell count. So some patients are anemic to start, and they might get more anemic. Other patients might have a decrease in their platelet count. So these are the most common blood side effects we watch for. And the non-blood side effects that we watch for would be the experience of, for some patients, headache, for some patients, dizziness, for some patients, easy bruising, for some patients, diarrhea. So we really need to talk about expectations. We need to go back talking about some of the objective things, something that the patient and doctor can look at together in the clinic and see improvement, and the improvement in the subjective, the patient's perceptions of symptoms.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We have another question from one of our online participants. So is there anything under the Affordable Care Act that helps cancer patients? Deborah Wolf, would you address that question in a general way, if you could?
Sure. Well, certainly some of the benefits I've mentioned, I think one of the most important is the elimination of caps on coverage, because cancer treatments can be very costly, and many people reach their caps and then receive letters after the law was implemented saying you're now covered again. The Affordable Care Act, I think, makes access to clinical trials easier, and certainly the right to an external review of any adverse decisions, any decisions denying coverage. And then, of course, the accessibility, the fact that everybody is entitled to a guaranteed issue policy and that there will no longer be exclusions for pre-existing conditions. So I could probably speak a long time on this, but in general, there's a lot of terrific benefits that the Act offers to people with cancer.
Thank you. And there's another question from one of our online participants. How can I find a support group near me? Sarah, could you address that question?
Absolutely. So one of the ways to find a support group that's near you, you can definitely call us at Cancer Care, and we will help you locate a support group that's locally situated near where you live. Also, the two resources I mentioned right at the beginning, and these are also the ones that Dr. Stein mentioned, which was the MPN Research Foundation and also the MPN Education Foundation. Both of those websites have listings for support groups. So if you are looking for something specific to MPN, definitely recommend checking out both of those websites because you're going to find listings there. And then, of course, you know, you may want to talk to your doctors or really anyone at the treatment center to see, okay, is there anything that they're aware of locally? And actually, I forgot one more, which is the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society also has support. So those are just a few places you can go to find support locally. And, of course, we are here to help you with it, too.
Excellent. Thank you. And then there's another question from one of our online participants. What should I take into consideration before participating in an MPN clinical trial? And there's a lot of information on the Internet. I don't know what to trust. Dr. Robos, could you address that?
Well, I think it's actually a really great question, and I want to take the second part first, that there is a lot of information on the Internet, and I congratulate the writer of the question for not trusting it, because just because it's printed on a computer screen doesn't mean that it's right. I think that it is very well worthwhile to do the research on what clinical trials you find that seem to be related to the MPN that you have. But I will caution patients and family members that the eligibility criteria for clinical trials, especially for patients with MPNs, can be quite garbled and difficult, because there are often references to specific aspects of the pathology, specific aspects of the blood counts, and specific prior treatments that patients may have had that actually make it a bit difficult to figure out which trial you're eligible for. So while I super encourage the motivation and finding things on your own, I actually think that this conversation with your treating physician is a very important one. And if the treating physician isn't at an academic center, I think this is the perfect opportunity to go back to something that Dr. Stein said earlier, which is get somebody who is at an MPN center involved, because we tend to know not only the clinical trials that are available in our own shop, but those that are available nationwide. And I can tell you that I personally ship people all over the place if there are trials that seem to be particularly important for a patient that I may not have open here. Well, we try to make arrangements elsewhere. So I don't think you should put the burden on yourselves to sort out which trial as much as to figure out, hey, you know, I think I've got a whole bunch of options for my disease. Go into your doctor's office, say, look, I think I found a whole bunch of things that might be relevant for me. Can you help me figure out which one is relevant? And if the doctor doesn't have experience with it, to make that connection with an MPN expert who will be able in 5 minutes to go one by one through all of the trials that you've identified and show you which are the ones that are really most appropriate for you.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been outstanding, both in your presentations and then addressing, of course, the questions that people have. And I also want to thank all of you, who've been listening to the call today, both who've posed questions. And this is, as you know, a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so, therefore, I do want to review with you the services of cancer care so that that although the call is ending soon, that you still have access to all of our services at cancer care. As Sarah had reviewed with you, we have a whole volume of services that we offer here at Cancer Care. They're all accessible by calling our 1-800-813-HOPE number. We have a staff of oncology social workers who are here to provide practical and financial assistance as well as counseling services. And most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with MPN and coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're here to help you. So please do give us a call. If you have a question and didn't get to ask it, please do call us, and we'll be happy to take your question and respond to you. And I want to thank you all for your participation, and have a wonderful day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.